Welcome to Asian Oscar Bait, the podcast that believes that John Cho should get to do everything Joseph Gordon-Levitt is allowed to do, and more.
Every week, we're going to tell you a story about a real-life Asian from history who we think should be the subject of a movie.
This is a special bonus episode of Asian Oscar Bait. We're still on hiatus, but we'll be back soon with another season of cinematic stories from all corners of Asian history.
In the meantime, we're going to share a brief account of a fascinating figure in Indian history whose experiences live close to home for one of our podcast's behind-the-scenes creators.
But before we do that, we're going to take a moment to discuss the soon-to-be-complete summer movie season in which Asian artists played a prominent role both behind and in front of the camera. So this past Friday, Melissa and Caroline and I saw Justin Chan's Gook, which is an independent drama about, I mean, I guess it's a bit deceptive to say it's like specifically about the LA riots, just because it's sort of, I think its narrative is a bit adjacent to it. I know it's getting a lot of, I mean, the attention it is getting is about its relation to the riots and specifically Korean American involvement, which is a subject that we've discussed on this podcast, specifically, I guess, the lack of stories that have been told from that perspective. So it's a really, I think its existence is really interesting. I don't know if it's getting necessarily the mainstream attention it deserves, perhaps.
But on that note, when we went to go see it, I feel like that was the most Asians I've ever seen in an American theater.
Oh, 100%.
Like the same, I just remember turning around because we sat near the front and like everyone in the back was Asian.
Well, even
like
coming, section. Even coming into the theater, I just noticed there was just like way more Asians than I've ever seen in a movie theater. Like it was, and it felt like, okay, maybe this is like an unusual instance, but like maybe more movies like this will be made and this will not be just like a rare occurrence.
I thought
but
it was just like a good example of like, you know, you put the stuff out there and people will come to support it just because like they want to see it.
And it was opening night. It was, you know, I think that also, like, Justin Chan is familiar to a lot of people.
And David So? I think it's So.
Yeah, he has a major YouTube follower.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
So.
But yeah, I guess we could talk about the movie for a bit.
Yes.
We didn't disclose
our... Well, first, let's talk about the plot really briefly. Yes. Which is the story of two Korean Americans who have inherited this shoe shop from their father, who has mysteriously died, and you kind of find out what happened at the end of the movie, so we won't spoil it. But it's about them and their relationship to this young black girl who comes to hang out in their store, and you also find out later in the movie how she's related to them. And, I mean, obviously spoilers for probably what we're about to say.
I think we'll try to be a bit more discreet with the film's details.
Yes, we'll try to be more discreet, okay.
Yeah.
But,
But yeah, and it takes place on the first day of the LA riots, the day when the officers who, you know, beat Rodney King within an inch of his life were acquitted. And then rioting commenced for multiple days in Los Angeles in 1992, which is the 25th anniversary, which is probably why I think we're seeing a large amount of just LA riot
related.
Yeah, like there was a documentary called LA 92, and there's a lot of other stuff that's in the works, so that's already premiered this year. But Gook is, like, as we said, I think maybe the only project this year, if not maybe the only, one of the only projects being told from a specifically Korean-American viewpoint, which makes it noteworthy. But I also think the film is pretty good, no? I can't exactly gauge what my expectations were going in because I feel like it premiered at Sundance this past winter, and I think it received like a quietly admiring reception.
Yeah.
It's hard to tell whether it's like maybe this is a great film that isn't getting the attention it deserves or if this is just something that should slip under the radar, deservingly so. But I was very moved by it and I was very appreciative just of the not only the Korean American perspective that was tapped into, but I think the ambition of the project itself, which taps into so many perspectives. I found it, I don't know, well-judged, I guess.
I thought the actors did a really good job. I was really impressed by David So. I thought he was really good. And also, even though his part wasn't that big, I was really impressed by the guy who played Camilla's brother, Keith.
Yes.
He was amazing.
Curtis Cook Jr., I think.
Oh, yeah, he was so good.
Yeah, I mean, There were two, I think at least two scenes in that movie. They're kind of extended scenes, and they involve that specific actor, Curtis Cooke Jr., who plays Camilla's brother. And they totally shook me to my core.
Yeah, he's amazing. He's so talented.
And yeah, it was just, but I think it's good. It harkens back to the point about how, I don't know, it's just a really intimate immersion within multiple family units and within mm-hmm. multiple relationships that I think, you know, I mean, yes, this film is about the Korean American experience, but it's also a microcosm of racial tensions in LA at that point, which is, you know, nothing, it's no small feat to accomplish that and to make it very moving and highly charged.
There were some points of concern that I did have. I still don't know how I feel about the title, just because I'm like, what would, like, non-Asian people call it?
Well, he discussed that. Yeah.
He discussed, I mean, I read what he said, but in I'm this still like, that's interview. Weird, because, like, I don't know. It's like, what would non-Asian people call that?
Yeah.
Like, could you say that, you know? Like,
there was a point when I got up to the box office, and I was just like, oh, like,
can I say like, that?
Can I have one for Gook? Like, it's just like very, okay.
Yeah, it's weird, right?
Yeah, I think I understand even beyond, I mean, he talks about that, like, that for him, that was the only title he could imagine. Right. Like, he tried coming up with different titles for it, but that just felt right.
Mm-hmm.
And it felt, I guess, to him almost like, and it does work within the film, because there are scenes that, there's one particular scene that involves
the
definition of it, and like, so it sort of works as a reclaiming of it on his part, but it's also an attention getter. I mean,
it's also one of those things where I went on Twitter after to look up how people had judged it, I guess, and mm-hmm. like, I typed that into Twitter, and obviously you see people using it as a slur, like, immediately.
Ooh,
yeah. Like, okay. But also people who were like, I think it's really shameful that you use this word to make it like the title of a film, mm-hmm. like older Asians, I guess.
Well, but I think what's really fascinating is he's talked a lot about how the mere fact of his making this movie has upset, I think, even people within his own family, but particularly the older generations who, I guess, you know, it's, I think the LA riots were incredibly traumatic for them,
mm-hmm.
Understandably so, but it's just an episode that they don't particularly care to revisit, and I think the idea of making a movie centered around this really painful time for, you know, these Korean Americans it just sort of baffles them, and it's something that he's sort of had to contend with. I mean, yeah, that Vulture interview I found really eye-opening.
Yeah, to an extent. His dad, Justin Chon, he plays the main character as well as directed it.
Yes.
And he wrote it as well.
Yes.
His dad plays the old Korean man in the shop next door.
Or across the street, yeah.
Across the street, I guess, yeah.
I didn't realize that until after the movie.
Yeah, that was pretty cool.
Yeah,
and like
what a naturally gifted actor his dad
was.
Yeah,
he was very good. I was really surprised.
Yeah.
Okay, so my other main question, though, that I had while I was watching the film is, as we discussed in your episode, the catalyst for the LA riots was not just Rodney King, but the murder of Latasha Harlan by a Korean American, or Korean, maybe like a first generation immigrant, I'm not sure actually.
It was a woman, it was a female shopkeeper, and working in her family's liquor store.
Yes, and she shot Latasha Harlins, who is a young woman, black woman, who came in to just buy orange juice, I believe.
Yeah.
And that was one of the catalysts for the LA riots, although Rodney King is the more popularized one.
Mm-hmm.
And to me, that was kind of a question I had the whole film, because when you saw like the young girl Camilla, she would like go into the shopkeeper's store, and I would be like, oh, she's gonna get like shot. It's like a callback to that. But then like nothing, you know? And I just thought it was weird, because not to say that Justin Chon has like a responsibility to like show this on screen, but, or even address this on screen, because like, you're right, it's like a microcosm of that particular time period. But it did feel to me like a bit disingenuous to have a film where you see like the young Koreans like treat like black people super well,
right?
And the more like ambiguous people are the black people, when actually like it was kind of the other way around, I suppose, in like the actual like historical narrative. mm-hmm. of the LA race riots. So, I mean, that was just the main question I had. Like, what did you think about that?
Yeah, well, those, I mean, there were a couple of scenes between Camilla and the shopkeeper, mm-hmm. played by Justin Chan's father. And the first one, like, gave me immediate pause.
Right.
Just because I remember that story very vividly. And, I mean, it just, it seemed like a very deliberate setup that was
yes.
calling back to that specific episode. But what's interesting to me is that I think the film, like, chose a very risky line in setting it up this way. But it played out the first interaction between them in which Camilla is arguing with the shopkeeper. And it ends in a sort of... not exactly violent way, but there's the possibility. There's a possibility of violence.
Oh yeah, yeah,
yeah.
Okay. I mean, for me, it was kind of like, yes, you're right. It's a callback to like that particular historic event. But first of all, most people don't know about that,
right?
So like, very few people in that theater, I'm sure, like had that moment of tension, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And
the thing that made me a bit nervous was that first encounter is very much played for laughs. In a way.
Was it? I was just like,
I think
so...
we have to. I mean, oh, really? I was just nervous laughter.
Well, I was very, like, maybe they were just laughing because it's like, oh, it's a funny Korean man. And you know, that's how.
I guess.
Asian people are played. But to me, I was like very nervous about it just because.
Oh,
so
yeah,
maybe
for
I wasn't
sure.
paying attention.
I mean, I couldn't tell. It's hard to gauge whether or not like laughter is like what kind of laughter. Is
yeah,
that.
Exactly.
But it felt like, maybe the situation felt broad enough that people could respond to it as just like a broadly comedic interaction or whatever. But I think as the scene intensifies, it becomes clearer. But yeah, I mean, Latasha Harlins was just in my head the entire time. And
right.
especially like because there are multiple interactions that follow after that. But yeah, I don't know. I think it's an interesting way to, you know, sort of mine this, you know, very well-known history and mm-hmm. play it up for sort of, you know, a very personal narrative.
Right.
Without necessarily, you know, didactically asking the audience, like, remember Latasha Harlins.
I don't know. Because we do have such few films about the Korean-American experience in that particular time period, I feel like it is disingenuous to play it this way because people don't really have that frame of reference.
True.
You know? So for me, I felt like, oh, that was really disappointing that, you know, they kind of like gloss over it. You know?
I guess, yeah.
And it seems unfortunate to me because I feel like the audience loses a lot of nuance just because they don't know about it.
Mm-hmm.
That's all. Like, it could have been mentioned in the news or something, like, because, you know, they're watching the TV.
Right. Well, I think what made me hesitant going into this movie just, like, prior to, like, just in terms, like, in the preceding months, even before, like, I knew,
mm-hmm.
it, like, even before it was acquired and, like, it had just played Sundance, I think what made me nervous was that this was going to be framed as sort of, like, just, this is, like, the Korean-American LA riots movie and, like, it's going to address everything, we're not going to need to ever depict this again. But
mm-hmm.
what I appreciated was maybe the actual small scale quality of the narrative and that it didn't feel a need to be this broad sweeping you know, encompassment of every single thing that occurred. I mean,
I don't think it could have been if like with their budget.
Oh yeah.
There's like no way.
I mean, I think he had to raise
like,
post production funds,
right?
Yeah, or some other crowdfunding site. But I know, I'm glad this film exists. I think it's, you know, really well done, if not, like, maybe remarkable. But
mm-hmm.
I think it's, I just kind of hope it inspires more Asian filmmakers, and specifically Korean filmmakers, to
tackle
sort of...
the subject.
Yeah, because I think there's still so much to unpack from that.
They left out a big piece of the puzzle.
Yeah.
So...
yeah, and... It's not necessarily Justin Chan's responsibility to cover all of that, but I do
mm-hmm.
think, you know, depicting it in the first place is a great start. And the film is great for what it is trying to do. And the performances are, as we said, really, really top-notch at times. So we could turn to maybe some other movies from the summer that we appreciated or that made news or made waves.
I mean, we're trying to keep it chronological order in order of things like that happened. First, very soon after the Oscars, aka our final episode, was Ghost in the Shell's major floppage.
Yes.
I don't know how badly it did, but it did badly.
It did very badly. Oh. And I feel like it was something that both critics trounced on and that audiences just had no time for.
Mm-hmm.
Which is, I don't know, it's, I mean, I didn't see it, and I know you didn't either, right?
No, I'm not so paying I feel, for it.
I know, so. It's just, it was, I mean, it's not even, like, something I'm, like, totally against seeing, but it was just, I think at that point, I really had no interest in supporting it.
Yeah, it's one of those things, like, I would see if I didn't have to pay for it. So, you know, maybe when it's on, like, a streaming service, I'll see it.
I just, yeah, I think my main takeaway from that failure is that I hope people in Hollywood are smart enough to realize that the failure of that is likely, I mean, or even just like the disinterest in that is largely due to, you know, people's frustration with the whitewashing as opposed to like, I don't know, people being tired of a female-led action movie, which is the
what
easy
Hollywood
way.
Hollywood likes to
Yeah,
believe.
It's what they would like to believe. Like, well, if this Scarlett Johansson-led, you know, action movie didn't make money for us, I guess people just don't want to see women kicking ass, you know, like, whereas I mean, there's a lot of reasons I think people steered clear of this movie.
Well, I mean, breaking news, I don't know if you saw this today, but I feel like the Ghost in the Shell flopping is having an effect already. There was this actor, did you hear about this, who dropped out of that film?
Oh,
this just happened today. So they cast this white guy in
what's
the
show?
New Hellboy, the new Hellboy
yes,
movie.
Yes, yes, I did hear about this.
And this guy, Ed Skrein? I honestly, I'm sorry. I don't know how to pronounce your name. He was cast as a Japanese character, and people were very mad about this through the weekend. But today, he resigned from the role in a public message that was very considerate. I mean, here's like an excerpt of it. He says, "It's clear that representing this character in a culturally accurate way holds significance for people, and that to neglect this responsibility would continue a worrying tendency to obscure ethnic minority stories and a voice in the arts. I feel it's important to honor and respect that. Therefore, I have decided to step down so the role can be cast appropriately." Which I thought was very classy.
That is classy.
Very cool. And Twitter is very happy, and people are saying, "Now you have no excuse." And he's like, not even a—is he a successful actor?
I've never heard of that name
before.
He looks
just like
me.
Nicholas Holt, but now I'm gonna say Nicholas Holt looks like him because
because he's done well by Asians. Yes.
Yeah. So now it's gonna be the opposite.
Well, yeah, I think that is, and that's something that would only happen in today's culture.
Mm-hmm.
I think it. No other decade of Hollywood would you be able to hear that, like, would that ever happen?
So, but, delighted.
Yeah.
And Ghost in the Shell was part of this history leading up to this. So, to continue on, what else did we have this year? Let's see. We had two big South Asian-led rom-coms. One was a TV show, which was Master of None, of course, Aziz Ansari's, and the other was The Big Sick, which was Camille Nanjiani's, best known from Silicon Valley.
Mm-hmm. I mean, for me, I think The Big Sick is, The Big Sick's, particularly its success, is really exciting because it's a film that was also at Sundance this year, where it was incredibly well received. But what's, I think, even more thrilling is that it's actually making a lot of money. It was made for $5 million, and it's, like, I think, on the edge of breaking $40 million in America.
No
like
way.
Probably it'll probably do it next weekend, but that's an amazing success. And I think the film is incredibly charming and, you know, deserves all the accolades it's getting. I was really, I don't know, I guess I just went into it, you know, intrigued but not necessarily expecting to be blown away, and I was, you know, very pleasantly surprised by how...
Yeah, I was the opposite, because I went in with really high expectations, and I was like...
I know we've talked about this.
It was fine. It was fine.
I mean, it's not like... Yeah, I guess it could...
Holly Hunter was the best part of the film, like, hands down.
Well, she's a queen.
Yeah.
She is
and
a queen.
I was like, oh, she's, like, the minorest supporting character of the supporting cast, and I was like, whatever.
I don't know. I mean,
no.
I think it's a good movie, and I appreciate that, like, this can be a good movie that is also a culturally specific movie.
Yes.
And that's, you know, consistently funny.
Yeah, it is funny. It is funny.
I feel like when I feel like it's a film I can praise and not have to, like, make excuses for, per se.
Yeah.
Although I was really interested in the discussion I don't think it's, like, was a predominant discussion, but I know a lot of people on Twitter were talking about why in films, particularly romantic comedies, where one lead is a man of color, like, why the female love interest is always white.
Mm-hmm.
And I do appreciate that, because I do think you could have easily had this film be just as effective if the Zoe Kazan girlfriend character was played by an actress of color. Like,
mm-hmm. But I mean, I see why it made people mad in, like, the context of also Master of None, which is, like, the other big, like, Asian-led, like, rom-com this year.
Yeah.
And also he goes for, like, you know, this
Italian
white girl.
Right.
Yeah.
I mean, what did you think of Master of None?
I really liked it when I first watched it, and then, like, I binged. I, like, watched it in, like, one night.
As everyone did.
Yeah. But I just thought, like, I mean, like, I got it, but also I was, like, I was expecting, like, a little more from the ending.
I haven't actually finished it.
Wow, okay. So you didn't binge it all in one night, like everyone.
No. But everyone I know who's watched it, like, over the course of a few days.
It's definitely funny.
I watched maybe, like, the first four episodes, and, I mean, I don't know. I really like it, and I appreciate his, the feeling of responsibility he has to sort of, like, particularly in his depiction of his parents, I guess, sort of, like, wade through the cultural responsibilities.
Even though his parents are, like, the worst actors ever.
You're so mean. His dad's fine. I think it's his mom who's just, like, clearly, like,
no,
just doesn't want to be there. His dad is fine.
Nothing compared to Justin Chon's father.
Well, Justin Chon's father is a virtuoso.
Yeah, he was great.
Yeah.
All right, moving on. We gotta get through this list. Other things that happened. You want to talk about Okja, since we talked about Netflix?
I mean, there were other films, I think, that, like, you know, led by Asian actors, but also made by Asian directors, that came out early this year and the summer, particularly Okja. So Okja was directed by Bong Joon-ho, who's a South Korean director. He directed Snowpiercer before, as well as The Host. I think it could have been really successful had Netflix not stuck to its model of just, like, dropping it the same day on its streaming site and only putting it in a handful of theaters across the country, because it's, I mean, I'm very much mixed on it. I think I admire its ambition while not necessarily feeling it's as well put together as it could be. But it's definitely an epic vision,
mm-hmm.
of capitalism and, you know, love and a bunch of other themes. But it deserves to be seen on a big screen. I feel like it could have been, like, at least a more sizable summer hit had Netflix, you know, committed to putting it on the screens it deserved.
Hmm.
But yeah, so if you haven't seen it, watch it. It's definitely worth a watch, whether or not you ultimately like it. I find myself very much torn on Bong Joon-ho in general. I feel like his satire is just incredibly broad. Like, just, he is not one for subtlety, and I don't always love that, but some people do, and I don't know. I mean, it's an endearing film more than anything.
Well, there are three other indies that were starring Asians this year that Matthew can go through, because I have not seen any of them.
No. Melissa just watched Master of None this year.
And that's it. It's the only thing I saw this year.
Yeah, so really quickly, three very different indie films that everyone should see, have they not. One is still currently in theaters. It's called Columbus. It's by this director named Koga Nada. And it stars our favorite,
John Cho,
playing the leading man role he deserves and yet never gets ever. But it's about this man whose father is, like, this architectural scholar, and he becomes ill in Columbus.
Ohio?
No, it's not. Fuck, what? It's Columbus.
Circle?
No, it's
Day?
Yeah, it's Columbus Day, Melissa. So John Cho plays the son of an architectural scholar who becomes ill in Columbus, Indiana, and so he has to go there. And it's about this relationship that's not really a love story, but it's more of just a very moving friendship between him and this girl who also lives there and is sort of stuck between stages of her life. It's a beautifully made film that's brilliantly framed, and I cannot recommend it enough. I think it deserves to be seen on a big screen just as much as Okja, even though it's an entirely different story. But yeah, if it's a small scale indie, so if it's in your town, you should definitely check it out. And also from earlier in the year, I cannot recommend Hirokazu Koreeda's After the Storm enough. It's this family drama by Japanese director Hirokazu Koreeda. It has beautiful performances by Hiroshi Abe and Kieran Kiki that, in an ideal world, I think would merit Academy Award nominations, but because it's Asian actors and it's a film that was not made in America, it might as well not exist. But it just tells the story of this failed detective novelist who had a lot of promise but continues to squander it. And it's about the relationships he has with his ex-wife and his son and his mother, played by the amazing, just like impossibly moving Kieran Kiki. And it's just an impeccably made film from early in the year, made by a director a lot more people should know. So check that out. And also of note is Abacus Small Enough to Jail, which is directed by Steve James, the documentarian who made Hoop Dreams and
who
The Interrupters.
Right?
I did interview him, and it was the best interview I've ever had in my life. He was like actually one of the, like a dream of a human being.
Aww.
Like that nice of a man. And you totally get that sensibility in his films, particularly Abacus, which tells the story of the Sung family who own this family-run bank called Abacus, and they have I think it's just like a handful of locations, one of which is in Chinatown. But they cater specifically to the Chinatown community, which is primarily a community of immigrants. You know, as only could happen in America, the only bank to be, I think, federally indicted during the 2008 mortgage crisis.
Wow.
So it's a study of a family, and it's a study of, you know, American persecution against immigrants, which could not be a more appropriate and urgent subject. And it's just, it's a beautiful film, and I really enjoyed spending time with this family, and it's ultimately a happy film.
Wow.
To not spoil too much. I mean, you could just Google it if you wanted to, but you should also watch the film. You should watch the film because it's really entertaining.
Yeah, well, speaking of happy endings, I have a lot of promise for the upcoming year. I mean, some like good stuff is Andy Mack on the Disney Channel, which is a TV series about an Asian family, starring three generations of Asian women. It's doing really well. It's like the highest rated of the Disney Channel, I believe, for young women, for girls. And also recently announced was Ali Wong and Randall Park are going to star in a rom-com together, which they've been talking about forever, actually, but is actually happening now. It's been written, so that's cool. Very excited to see that. I'm sure it'll be hilarious because they're awesome.
Dreams can come true, even
Dreams
in Trump's America.
And now for our very special episode, we are going to have Caroline Pinto, one of our producers, well, our only producer, talk about an amazing story from her family that she recently found out about.
Like many of my ancestors, my great-great-uncle, Dr. Rosendo Ribeiro, was born in the town of Porvorie, Goa. For those who don't know, Goa is the state on the west coast of India and was one of the longest surviving Portuguese colonies in the country, all the way up until 1961. This is why many Indians of Goan heritage are Catholic and have Portuguese surnames, such as myself. When it seemed like the Portuguese rule might have been coming to an end, many Goans migrated to countries in East Africa which were still under the British regime, like Kenya. Rosendo arrived in Nairobi in February 1900, where he quickly made a name for himself by becoming the country's first private medical doctor. For 6 months, he and his assistant, known only as Mr. C. Pinto, lived together in a tent where they concocted prescriptions by candlelight, one of which was a cure for malaria. Eventually, he expanded his practice in the Indian Bazaar, but the medical officer of health had it burned to the ground after Rosendo discovered two cases of the bubonic plague there, a disease which was little understood by others in East Africa at the time. What Rosendo is most remembered for, though, is not his medical achievements, but rather his domestication of a zebra. In the early 1900s, automobiles were not yet widespread in Nairobi, and horses didn't fare well in the tropical climate. Yet most people still hadn't bothered to try and domesticate zebras. It was either thought that the animals were too untrainable, or that they were better off being skinned for decorative purposes or kept in zoos. Rosendo, however, somehow managed to tame one of these creatures, and he would famously ride it around the city making house calls. If you Google Rosendo Ribeiro, the first thing that pops up is an image of him sitting atop the zebra. Rosendo grew to become an almost larger-than-life figure in the Nairobi community. Near the end of his life, after World War II, when only a few people in the city could afford cars, he could be seen being chauffeured around in a limousine. Even Mass at St. Francis Xavier Church would not begin until he and his wife had arrived. But even at the height of his career, he would still make time to personally attend to even the most minor ailments. And when the community was struggling with the lack of schools, he made his premises available for use as classrooms, which would later become the Dr. Ribeiro Goen School. Rosendo definitely lived an exciting life all the way up to his death in 1951, but if a movie were to be made about his life, I think it would be most interesting to focus on his early career in Kenya and the adventures of him and his assistant as they created new medicines in a little tent. There would be plenty of drama with the plague and fire and all of that, but of course, it would also have to showcase his relationship with the zebra, which could be either comical or heartwarming, or maybe both.
Okay, so Caroline, when did you first discover the story about your uncle?
I actually only heard about him for the first time a few months ago at a family dinner when some relative mentioned it, and I was like, how have I never heard about this guy before?
Oh, wait, like, which part did they mention first, though? Like the zebra?
Or the medical stuff?
It's important. I don't even remember what we were talking about, but I think it was basically that we had a relative who is a doctor who rode around on a zebra.
I feel like that's so you, Caroline.
That is just so, it's so your aesthetic, yeah.
Does it explain a lot about me?
Yeah, I think so. The zebra domesticator. Well, the funny part is that his assistant was Mr. C. Pinto.
I was like,
Caroline Pinto, was it you?
Is this your second life? Oh my god.
Yeah. Well, wasn't there like a weird thing with like the families, like your dad's family and your mom's family like knew each other like way back when also? Was that like during, it was like a weird complicated family tree thing.
Yeah, I mean it was a pretty tight-knit community in Goa, especially in this town of Porvorí where I like ancestors from both sides of my family who are from that town, so I think it's kind of like everyone knew everyone.
But is Mr. C. Pinto related to your dad Pinto?
I honestly have no idea, because really Pinto is kind of like the Smith of Goan names. So. Okay.
Yeah, I've heard Aang is the Smith of Chinese names.
I want to pretend that.
Sure, we can pretend. We can believe. That,
I want to believe that Mr. C. Pinto and Ribeiro ended up, like, their family lines converged
I actually know the least about my Pinto side of the family. So
wow.
Could be.
Who knows what else is laying dormant there?
Like, yeah. So did Mr. Ribeiro ever, like, get married and have kids or what?
I think I mentioned at the end he and his wife would go to church together.
Oh right, I got like really distracted by the part where he was like in the tent with like Mr. Pinto, and I was like maybe they're together.
That's just when this whole theory came about.
Theory, and somehow they produced you.
So yeah, I think I would say like the premise that you came up with is sort of, I think, like, what immediately stuck out to me as a movie. Like, I just find this, like, I think even just the visual of two men creating medical ailments in a tent is very funny, but also, like, very adorable in a way.
It's very, like, Sherlock Holmesy. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, that action adventure film.
It's a buddy comedy.
It's a buddy comedy, but with, like, action, fire, plagues, and a zebra.
What more could you ask for in movies?
Yeah, that's a summer blockbuster everywhere.
Yeah, I don't know. I think this could be a really interesting, even, I mean, like, on top of, like, the buddy comedy and action-adventure elements, like, a really interesting character study of, like, a very eccentric personality. I don't know. I mean, it's, like, one of those, it's, your uncle seems like one of those characters who could only exist in the movies, and yet he existed in real life, and it's just...
The picture of him is wild.
I know, Melissa showed me it, and I was just like, yep, this deserves to be on our podcast.
Yeah. It's truly wild. Okay, so the zebra character.
It should talk, right? No, I return.
Interesting.
I think we're, like, in terms of, like, cinematic predecessors, right, we're definitely thinking Dr. Doolittle, right?
Or Donkey from Shrek.
Well, both Eddie Murphy classics.
So I was kind of thinking we could go in two directions with the zebra. There's also, like, the other, like, more serious way of presenting the zebra, but also, like, serious, like, comedic, which would be the kangaroo, the young pope, if anyone saw I made Caroline watch the young pope.
I watched three episodes of
the
young pope.
Well, then you saw the kangaroo.
Of course.
Do you see where I'm going with this?
I think you just want to talk about the young pope. It's like nobody else in the world remembers that Siri existed but Melissa.
No.
I think also what stuck out to me, and something I'm just curious, I guess, for more details about, is his wife. And I'm just curious about the history of that marriage and, like, how they met and maybe what she thought about this very eccentric
zebra,
man.
Yeah.
No.
Oh, yeah. Also the man.
Yeah. Yeah, sadly, I don't know too much about her. Even in researching the rest of my family, I've always found there's been more information on the men than the women, sadly.
Yeah.
So that's something I, too, would love to know more about.
Yeah, I wonder, like, was she a very... You can't be a very serious person, can you, if you're marrying someone who, like, rides around on a zebra?
I think it would just be cool if... I mean, if there's not that much known about her, she's just a female character who's incredibly game for his adventures, and...
I mean, also, honestly, given the time period and the culture, it was most likely an arranged marriage.
Right.
And she was also going, and so I don't know if she happened to be living in Kenya at the time, or it was brought from Goa to marry him, or...
Oh my, that would be a mess if you were brought from somewhere else to come marry a man who rode around on a zebra.
That is perfect for
me. Like, cures the plague.
It's perfect for movie drama.
But hey, look, he was taking her around in a limousine by the end of their
church
life,
didn't begin until they walked in the damn chapel. Like,
yeah. Didn't do too badly.
Yeah, clearly not, so...
I don't know, I feel like most of what we're coming up with is slanted towards the comedic, but almost, I think it, I don't know, I feel like a comedic tone almost befits this story in an unusual way.
But just the details we know about it, at least.
It's just, it's funny. It's funny in a light way, but, I mean, he was also doing, like, really invaluable work, it seems, like, creating these, you know, ailments, which is, you know, in its own way, heroic work.
Yep.
Yeah. I mean, I guess I also almost saw it as a bit of a dramedy, or, like,
yeah,
I feel like it could definitely have both elements, because, I mean, when you're dealing with the plague, I feel like you have to be a bit serious at some point.
Yeah, I was gonna say, there's a lot of death.
I don't know what you're talking about. I've always found the plague hilarious.
Well, maybe it could be a very dark comedy.
Do you know who'd be super good at directing this?
Who?
Not Asian, I'm sorry, but Yorgio.
Yorgos Lanthimos?
Yes. He did The Lobster.
Yes, I am...
Wouldn't that be so good?
Yeah.
Well, he could kill this movie.
So I think now we're thinking more along the lines of, like, a surrealist dramedy.
Just the zebra.
Okay. Maybe this is, like, his most grown-up movie. It's, like, it's like the story of a man, and then the story of a marriage, and the story of a zebra.
That's probably the tagline for his movie, TBH.
Yeah. Oh, we should... Yeah, that would
Let's
be the title.
Him.
The story of a man, the story of a marriage, the story of a zebra. I don't know what else you could want from movies. Like,
yeah.
Yeah, that would definitely be an interesting take on the story, especially since it's a true story. I feel like it would almost make people feel like it wasn't true.
True!
Yeah.
But it's, like, so true, right? It seems like it's not true.
I think you just have to, like, play the just, like, strangeness of the situation.
Yeah.
Like, taking it seriously, maybe, is it? Like, taking it,
right,
you know, isn't just the most entertaining route.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, there's, like, no... If you made this boring, there's, like, something wrong with you
as
a filmmaker.
Like, all the material is here. You, like, you really...
Yeah.
You would have really screwed up. So, C. Pinto, we're thinking, is sort of the Josh Gad role.
The Indian Josh Gad.
Oof. Anyway, moving on. Okay, so to wrap this up, Caroline, what do you think would be the most entertaining scene in this yet-to-be-made movie about your uncle?
I think it would be really funny because, as I mentioned, most people were very dubious that zebras could be tamed, so to see Rosendo going up to the zebra in a crowd of naysayers and forming a bond with him and just, like, naturally domesticating the zebra.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
The zebra whisperer.
Yes, exactly.
I love a good scene where, like, the entire town is proven wrong by one man.
Yes!
By one man with a dream.
That's a classic. Like,
it's a classic trope, but it never fails to make the audience smile.
Asian Oscar Bait is hosted by Matthew Wang and Melissa Powers, produced by Caroline Pinto, with music by Rena Minagishi and marketing by Alina Haim.
Come say hi at Asian Oscar Bait on Twitter or on our website, www.asianoscarbait.com. If you like the show, spread the word to everyone you can. A great way of doing that is by rating and reviewing us on Apple Podcasts, which helps our podcast find new listeners. What's something we could ask you to wrap it up? Maybe, like, how much of the profits do you want?
Oh, that's a good 100%. One. All right, you start.
No, I'm not going to actually ask her how much of the profits do you want.